Welcome to Spill Radio. This program is being recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. I am Tatiana Melma, hosting this program on behalf of the Morrison Helen Belkin Art Gallery at the University of British Columbia. Spill Radio is presented in collaboration with CITR 101.9 FM, with sound production and editing by Joshua Stevenson. Today's episode includes a public event that was recorded at the Belkin Art Gallery during Spill Response, curated by Guadalupe Martinez, that was a live research and performance component of the exhibition Spill. This event included a conversation between Twistonaut Cece Weiss and Anne Riley with Martinez about their collaborative practice and their current project, A Constellation of Remediation. Twistonaut Cece Weiss is Squamish, Stolo, Hawaiian Swiss, and is an interdisciplinary artist, ethnobotanist, educator, and food security activist with a 30-year practice that engages with communities, technologies, and ecosystems by sharing stories. Anne Riley is a multidisciplinary artist whose work explores different ways of being and becoming, touch, and indigeneity. Riley is Cree and Dene from Fort Nelson First Nation and received her BFA from the University of Texas at Austin. Today's episode will include soundscapes recorded by Yasmin Whaley Kalerowa at the UBC Farm.
Yeah, I remember the first mentor meeting. I would just walk through this forest and slowly started to cultivate a relationship of care and trust. And I think Cece is someone who really moves at the speed of trust. I just read Adrienne Marie Brown's great book, Pleasure Activism. Mm-hmm. I really recommend it. Mm-hmm. And her book, Emergent Strategy, she talks about that. What does it mean to move at the speed of trust, which is actually really, you have to it's not a colonial time, very decolonial time to think about what that is. But how do you move at that? Sometimes you can move at that in certain relationships quicker. I think with Cece, we were able to build that because our values seemed very similar. So there wasn't, we both cared about healing at the base of our practice and how that will ripple out and affect so many other people and systems, because that's truly what the work is about for us. And that you can't do the work alone. So in art school, you're taught to do it alone, that it is about you. But it's so much bigger than you. It has actually nothing to do with you. And so Cece, I think, is, again, mentoring with someone like that who has really taught me that, and someone like Lei Wan. I've been so lucky to have that. And so Cece, an open call came up for a public art commission through the city of Vancouver. And so we were like, okay, let's go through this process of applying, which is very, it's a performance. Every application is a performance. So for us, it was, okay, looking at the history of public art, what is that? And I'd never worked in public art. Cece has been working in it for quite some time, been really important works across the city. And so we applied to do a work called A Constellation of Remediation, which involves we applied and proposed to install indigenous remediation gardens across the city, ideally in vacant gas station lots. And we were commissioned, and we were the only indigenous artist commissioned out of about six projects, I believe. And Cece and I had the kind of feeling we would have been called to do with this project. We both had surgery during it. We both were but we're also indigenous women bodies fighting a colonial system. Of course, we're going to come up against certain things in our bodies. And so how do we hold each other? Well, I pick her up when she's had surgery and take care of her. Because that is also the work. It's not separate from the work. The work is also how we're helping each other heal. And through that goes into every site and every workshop we do, every person that we have a conversation with. And so we're 2 years into the project now, finally just got our sites. No, we didn't get any vacant gas stations. And that time of waiting, the first year of waiting, you've got a lot of no's, everybody, all the gas stations. Because that was during the time in Vancouver where all of the, like, the chevrons, everything in downtown Vancouver, there's not a gas station in downtown Vancouver except on Davie, because those lots are worth so much money to the developers. Mm. And so, and then it was funny, at the same time, they were turning them into community gardens. If you see them around, mm-hmm. they were turned, these developers, and how they're still developing a space. Mm-hmm. They're not actually healing it. They're still developing. And so that was our project. Our project is not to develop another space. It's to heal it, and there's a big difference between that. And so we're like, wow, that's really interesting timing that these developers are like using the metaphor of a garden to think about community, and that's obviously not their intention, but it's a mask, you know, and you can, within these intellectual spaces, that's what you have to wear when you're, which is industry, which is all intellectual in the head, because you can't be in your heart and do what these people are doing. You just can't. It just doesn't actually work. It's not how our hearts and our bodies actually work. So we for a year we got no's, and it was really, it took a toll, I think, creatively, because we got commissioned, we were like, this is exciting, and it's truly a project of duration. So how do you keep your fire going when this industry is like, it's keep dampering it, you know, and you're like, oh, you have to constantly find kindling. So like, you can't build a fire alone, you can't keep doing that alone. So we've been doing that for each other, and but that year of no's for the public art project was so crucial because it speaks to a colonial time and a colonial consciousness that we're up against. And so then we were like, okay, these sites are not working. They're obviously not there, and that's where we needed to know that you're not. These gas station sites, this industry isn't there yet. And so, well, now we need to access decolonial places. So we went to the Native Education College, had our first meeting, and they're like, yep, on board, sign off, whatever. Like, we'll do that. You know, and then it was just like, oh, it started to light the fire again. You know, and it was like, oh. And then we didn't have to explain a lot. Like, it was just, mm-hmm. they got it. Then we went to Anya, and then they were like, yes. And we're like, we'd love to use this site next door. And like, so we finally, so it was interesting encountering still these institutions, the Education College and Anya are still institutions, but they're decolonial institutions. And so, and they're places of knowledge still, but a specific knowledge. And so we finally now have our sites, but now I think we're both left with like, how do we keep our fire going? Because it's been such a long time. You're like, how do we get our creative, like, it's interesting looking back at how, why I was excited in the beginning of it, and now how it's like truly become, it's a marathon. And that's what the system does, this colonial time, that it wears you out. And so, and like, because you have to constantly explain yourself. And so you need each other to, so that you're like, right, we're doing this thing. This is why we're doing it, because we love each other, and we love man, and we love flowers and plants. And this is because it's also knowing what makes you feel alive, and those relationships that make you feel like the human, the more than human. So that's a project that we're doing that relates to this concept of remediation in industry, and but for us in our work together, we've done other collaborative works like for the BAMP Center, and we're all still related to plants and healing, but I think Cece and I are not, in the way we make together, it's not, you're never thinking about how to make an object. It's more about what is the energy of something. Because any object, whatever it is, if the energy is based in this really beautiful chemistry, any object can hold that really beautiful chemistry. And so we're not, I don't really think of ourselves as object makers, which I kind of like, because it's kind of going up, it's outside of the margins of the art world, because it's obsessed with production and obsessed with product. And I think that in itself is also an industry. And so for us as artists, we don't, that's not how we think of making. And which really is this beautiful space when you stop thinking of that and that kind of making, it opens you up to all these other possibilities. So for us, it's like an art project we'll do is, it'll be a sunset workshop and we'll just ask people to watch the sunset together. That in itself is a beautiful energy.
Yesterday we were at the farm. Anne made a fire and we gathered around the fire and we made offerings and then we harvested some medicines that you told us what they were, shared stories around them. We made tea as well and we helped clean one of the gardens. We took weeds.
Mm-hmm. And food.
We had some food. At one point when we were sort of talking about the meaning of being together and performing these kinds of actions and sort of the labor of healing or the labor of love or something along those lines, you quoted bell hooks, Anne, and you were mentioning this phrase that she has, that it says, every act of love is ending domination. And I was wondering if you could speak to that in sort of this quality that both your practices have and conjuring many practices and traditions through sort of like love actions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the main aspects, although I think it's kind of like almost in a way summarizes what you both do, but I think that's how I was thinking of the program of these love actions as gestures that end domination or have the potential to really transmute that.
Yeah, is that the quote was bell hooks? I was reading in some magazine, she was having a conversation with another Buddhist who had just written a book about love, and she bell hooks had this quote that said, "Every time we do the work of love, we are doing the work of ending domination," and that like really hit me because I was like, "Oh, like that can be so small, like it's like," and it's. And how even like, well, if I'm talking more, and what I love about bell hooks too is that she's like, really dismantles like yes, we can talk about romantic love and we definitely have an obsession with it in Western culture, which takes us away from like a really deeper love, I think. And so thinking around this idea of like, how do I cultivate a practice of self-love that ends the things that are dominating me? Because like, so I can feel free of that domination that's within me, that's like dominating the decisions I'm making, so that the decisions can feel more like freedom. But I've noticed too in our workshops, someone shared with me recently when we did a workshop on Main Island for a queer residency called Slow Waves, we brought in all these medicines and it was so beautiful. We brought it and like, because we know we love coming into closed spaces because we just try to lift it up. And so I knew like a lot, there had probably been a lot of processing, some queer space. And so I was like, there's gonna be some processing done. And so I was like, we gotta bring the medicine. And so we brought it, it was so beautiful. Everybody was in a circle and like we just were like, oh, we went to the garden just like we did before this, and we picked all these medicines, and we picked roses and flowers and comfrey and all of these other. And then I just could sense, I was like, oh, everyone just touched the plants, and so everybody was just sitting there like touching the rose, and I was watching everybody just blossom, and they were just like, something was opening up in them, and it was like the love of that beauty is one thing, but they really needed that medicine. And so I was like, oh, they don't need to hear us talk about stuff. Like, they've done enough of that. Like, there's so much that doesn't need to be said, but just, but, and so there was, and Cisa and I had made bundles for all the people who had programmed it and everything. And I'm so moved every time when you start with generosity with people, not as an intellectual choice, but as a heart choice, how that shifts people and the way in which we relate to each other and the way we make and the way we create relationship. And because there is a difference between it being an intellectual choice, which is a colonial way of, and we see that all the time, truth and reconciliation, all this money being given to indigenous people. This is like an intellectual act of generosity. It's not actually generosity. So we have to really unlearn all of that. So what does that feel like? We've all probably had moments like that. And it heals a lot of that other trauma when generosity has been given to you intellectually, or love has been given to you intellectually, or we've given love intellectually, because that's how we're taught. So it was so beautiful to watch all of these people just like, I could tell they were so tired, but then they got like, that medicine was offering them, and maybe possibly the generosity of us being like, oh, here, like, we've come with this basket, and we won't leave until it's empty, and then we take everything, which is also a priestess poem that I read to the students the other day about, she has this beautiful poem about this kind of generosity, which is kind of like a learning of an indigenous generosity. And so, but one of the participants was so beautiful and came up to me after we were about to leave, and they had shared with me, like, quite emotional, and they're like, thank you so much for the gift you offered. And I realized, like, you don't even know me, and you just gave me this medicine. She's like, I realized we can start from there. And I was like, we can, but not in every space, because it's not starting there. But we can start there. But how can we make those spaces where we do start there, since the other alternatives don't offer us those spaces? So I think those are kind of the basis. A lot of, like, you know, Cisa and I, we have to think about, like, will this space let us start from generosity? If not, I'm not sure it'll feed the deeper parts that we need to be fed to do our work. And that cuts out a lot of opportunity. But it's worth it, because that's also the act of self-love in our practice, of knowing what nourishes us. That's really, really crucial. Just all part, and I think, yeah, all of those things are like, you don't have to use the word love. It's actually better if you don't, because it's all of that. All of those gestures and those understandings.
Back to when Anne and I first met, and I was like, I don't know what she wants, but I'm just going to tell her that whatever she needs to know, the land will teach her. and I think that was really profound that I just kind of said that to you, and you were like, oh my God.
Of course it will. You just helped me. This woman doesn't help me. Oh, we can start from generosity.
Yeah. And everything that we've collaborated on, we sit in gardens and we talk, because the land is teaching us, it's nurturing us, it's feeding our soul, and it's also telling us how to work from our own selves. Not to put an expectation on each other, not to say, what will Anne give to me in my practice? What will, you know, Anne thinking, what will Cisa give to me in my practice? It's like, let's sit with the land and let's be guided by that. And, you know, when we went to Banff, the original idea was to take the work with our constellation project and some of our findings there, but with all these hurdles, we were like, okay, what do we got? Let's go sit in the land. And just sitting there, we're talking, and, you know, and butterflies are going by, and bees are going by, And it became like, you know, just that dialogue in that safety of the earth. And we mostly go to the community garden in my community, Harmony Garden, and that was started by elders, mostly matriarchs in our community, that had a fear that our children would not know where food came from. But, you know, we're a very urban-centric nation because we're on the water and we're now surrounded by this metropolis, and even the upper Squamish part of our territory in House Sound, it's still very, very urbanized. And so we have often been accused of being like too urban. It's not our fault. We didn't ask for this. It's just been thrown literally on top of us and all around us. And even our community is spread everywhere. And you know, it takes us years. It took me years to hear the stories that of our people here. You know, and even on this land here, because we've been here a long time, and we didn't have these borders. Everybody sees it as, oh, you're over here, you're over here, you're over here. But we don't, as Indigenous people from here, we don't see that. And I often hear people say they're confused by the, you know, which territory is yours? Like, where in the city? It's like, it's all shared. You know, we didn't sit there writing memos about it. And in some nations, it's about the water line. It's about the creek. If you cross over the creek, you're crossing into someone else's community. And when I've talked with the Shkwetan people and the Seal people, they talk about that. They always say, oh, we have to drop some coins. I'm like, what? Oh, we have to drop coins when we cross the river. So they're dropping, they're actually giving back that those minerals that have been all stripped out of the land. And I thought that was really fascinating. I'd be driving with one of my friends and she'll be on the Coquihalla and roll down the window and throw change out.
Hey, but that doesn't hit somebody's window. Like, I come in some fear, but then I'm like, that's my own fear.
But it made sense to me. I thought that was taken out of the land. The land didn't have a choice. It's taken away and stripped away from it. It's very volatile, right? And so it's those kinds of things that we, you know, we think about how we travel, even through, when I travel through the city, like, oh, really try to see it through in my ancestors' eyes. And, you know, like, you think about the neighborhood. There's so little that's been named after our people that even our people in our communities don't even know the interwoven elements of what brings us together and holds us together, those weaves from centuries ago. And it's often at funerals or weddings or other rites of passage that happen that we start to see who we're related to and why. Started learning on my early path in ethnobotany, and I was determined to only learn through Indigenous people. That, you know, there's two roads. You can go the academic route and you can be done that in 8 years, or you can do the lifelong journey that you're always going to keep learning. And that's the road I chose. And it was really hard in the beginning, but I have really made my life practice about making that accessible, that knowledge. And really started with my daughter, training her, and now she is training people and she's training her daughter. And so we're seeing that intergenerational. Like, it was stopped. My mother gathered medicines, learned about them, but couldn't share that because of the residential school, because of colonization. And it wasn't until I started working in it, she started to tell me stories about how she picked medicines when she was younger. And that a lot of it was for making money for research, that people were researching Devil's Club and other things like about 50 or 60 years back. And that all that is coming out now. And I continue to laugh about how at times I've been challenged by people saying, well, how do you know this is true? And I'm like, well, just wait, scientists will show you, like, and it's true. Like, they are all proving everything. I ended up watching a show on Devil's Club being researched here at UBC, and everything that they researched was everything they had heard from Indigenous people, and it was all true, that it helped with arthritis and diabetes and tuberculosis and energy and everything, and it just continued, right? And then we have our spiritual beliefs with those medicines. Mm. And so then I met a woman before we were online. neither of us had email addresses at the time, so we just wrote each other letters and sent them off and waited for our mail to arrive. Read our stories about each other, and because I bought a book of hers, and I sent her a letter asking her if I could make a video with her creation story, and we still have dialogues today and talk about it. And I was so fascinated because she talked about how different plants grow with the purpose of taking away the trauma from the earth and releasing it. And so mullein was a big one that was like, you'll see mullein growing in industrial sites, and it's healing as it grows, and it's pulling all these toxins out and releasing them. And so my scientific interest was, does it affect the pollinators? Does it affect people if they're consuming those, right? Especially the pollinators, will they be affected? And the more that I've learned about that, like sunflowers too, and how bees pollinate all these plants that are in industrial zones, but it doesn't poison them. Mm. And that, you know, the seeds drop after they've been pollinated, they turn to fruit and then seeds, and then they grow more, and they continuously do that work. And it made me understand how the earth really is the most healing entity around us. Like, we are on this planet that heals itself. Mm-hmm. All this trauma that goes on, it continues. How does it continue? Because it is so resilient. And that as humans, as the youngest species on the planet, and potentially the greatest, but currently the worst species on the planet, we're still here. We're trying to reach for there. We're trying to become evolved to that better species of ourselves. Whereas the bee is perfect, you know. Bees are perfect. They don't have to evolve anymore. Mm. They're already there. Mm. And same with mushrooms. They, you know, the more that we read about different mushrooms and what their abilities are, it's just fascinating how they help trees talk to one another, how they send messages through the forest. They are the original internet, you know. And a lot of my stories are shared with children, like really young children. And I always say to people, newborn to 99, that's the range I work with. And it really is that way. Like, you go into the woods with people, and everybody, I can go in with the most uninterested person and have them hooked, because it's not what I'm saying, it's what the forest is saying. Because I help reconnect people to what they're missing in life is the forest and the land. And I'm sustained by that, I'm fed by that wonderment and that moment where people actually latch on to the knowledge and hold it and become thrilled by it. Because I feel like if we don't spread that knowledge, that we're all in trouble. So it's, you know, I feel it's becoming more and more urgent for us to continue to share the knowledge of what the land does for us and how it sustains us, and how with that knowledge that we all can add more of that important element of the knowledge of, you know, the remediation, and how it brings us all forward. So it really, it's the reciprocity factor again in action. Like, you know, on days like today, when you go out, you don't see it, but subconsciously you feel that there are spores flying in the air, just floating, and there are ferns and different fungus, not just mushrooms, but lichens. Lichens are fungus too. And they're all floating, and mosses, and they're all floating in the air, and we are breathing those in. They're helping us just by breathing. People will say, oh, I don't like herbs, or I don't drink tea, or, you know, there'll be a list of all the resistance factors that people have. Oh, I don't need to do that. Well, just go breathe in a forest. Just go sit in a forest and breathe, and you will feel the medicine in your body. You will feel the difference than you feel inside a climate-controlled environment where you can only breathe so much of that air, but you go into the forest and it's just, it's regenerating right around you. And we're sharing, like, what we breathe out, the plants breathe in. So it's just continuous. And I think that's why reciprocity has become a big driving force for me and my work, and the work that Anne and I are doing. I just feel like I'm so excited by it, because it's like we owe the planet so much. We have to give back something. We can't just keep taking from it. And for us to do this work and to have it teach others and reach far out to others, inspiring just how to use these plants. Every one of us growing one plant in the spring, one plant in the fall, can feed the pollinators longer. Doing that work, planting something to heal the earth, it's going to give back to the next generations. You know, like seeing this young child come in today, we all have to remember that we owe that generation so much, because they're growing up with so much taken away from them. And even if we think that we have it all, we still don't. And what can we give to the next generations? Not just the next one, but the next several. And that's a whole indigenous worldview. We never think about just ourselves and right now. We think, what will my future ancestors think? What will they wonder about me and my generation and what we gave or took? What did we give back? So I think that's a big part of what excites me about our work, is that the work we're doing isn't just interesting and cool because of what these plants do. It's about a hopeful gift to the future.
If you haven't had a chance to visit yet, the exhibition Spill is open at the Belkin Art Gallery until November 30th, 2019.